Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Now You Know, talk radio where you get to ask the questions. Call us now at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. And now, here are your hosts, Ann Mitchell and Brian McCullough.
Well, that's us. Hey, Ann.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Oh, I'm so very excited. I can't even tell you. I've really been giddy all day about this show. I can't wait.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. I have to ask you, though, how come you always get second billing?
Because your name starts with an A and my name starts with a B.
What if we go alphabetically by last name? You actually would come just a scooch before me.
Yes, but I always will defer to beauty. So you will always trump me there. So forever and ever, you will be primary billing in our relationship, and I'm okay with that. I've come to grips.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. Hey, we have got something new for this show. Do you want to tell everyone about our exciting new vanity phone number?
Well, it's interesting you say that because being that this is our first show, I think everything is new, correct? So, I mean, we did have one fake show last week, but what you did today was really exciting. Yes, we have a vanity number. I'm so excited about it. The show is Now You Know, and we have a number for you to call in right now, 877-NYK-RADIO. That's Now You Know Radio, 877-695-7234. And this show really is going to not be as interesting if we don't have folks call in and ask people questions. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. The intent of this show is to bring in experts from various fields, top-of-the-line people that know a lot about whatever it is their field is, and then give folks a chance to call in and ask them questions. I mean, I think it's going to be a unique experience because you're going to have access to people that you might not otherwise. I mean, a lot of people follow technology podcasts or technology shows or medical shows, whatever, but this is going to be kind of a smorgasbord of just a bunch of different folks, and so I'm excited about it. So, Ann, I'm really excited about who you were able to snag for tonight's show.
Oh, I am very excited about that, too. But before we go on to our expert for this week, I just want to say one other thing about this phone number, because it is really cool that this phone number has a secret identity. Actually, it being the call-in number for the show, so guests can call in to talk to the expert and ask them questions, that's its secret identity. Its
okay.
regular identity for the other 22 hours and 6 days of the week is it's the place that anyone can call in and tell us what you think. Call 877-NYK-RADIO and let us know what's on your mind. And it doesn't have to be a guest request. It could be anything. If you've got a rant, if you have just something that you are dying to say to someone or it's going to burst out of you, call us and tell us what you think about anything at all. So that's
well, and what's
cool.
What's great about that is we'll – of course, play some of the more interesting ones on the air, but something might come up that somebody, wants to talk about that will spark us to find an expert for that. So it can be a request or it can just be a vent or a rant or whatever. We'd love to hear it because then we can do something with it, either play it or find an expert or, just laugh about it. But that number is 877-NYK-RADIO, 877-695-7234. So please call in if you're listening. Of course, at this point, you may not know why you would call in. So, Ann, why don't you fill us in on what we're going to be discussing tonight?
I am. I am so very excited to have this woman on our show. She is an amazing woman who is doing incredible things for animals. She has been working in the animal rescue field for years. She's worked at some of the top shelters in the country. She has been in charge of the county animal control, taking care of the animals. And I think she's got some stories she might tell us about how she even went the extra mile to help some animals to make sure that they got homes. And she's just, like I said, an incredible person. She's writing two books. She runs fashion shows for animals. She is just all that. And her name is Jessica Stout. And Jessica, are you there?
I'm here.
Now, Jessica, one of the things I wanted to say is that you have written an article. It's called Confessions of a Euthanasia Technician, and that article on the internet has garnered so many comments, so much attention, and I've read the article. I have to say it was a very hard thing to read, but just so necessary to read. And really, the comments that you get from that article are just astonishing. The chord that you have struck, the depth of emotion, you really tapped into something. It's, you know, the people who work at animal shelters, at humane societies, who day in and day out have to put other people's pets to sleep because those people turn them in for whatever reason. Either they had to, or you certainly have stories I know where perhaps it didn't have to end that way. Heartbreaking, but those people, no one really thinks about them and what they go through. And I'm wondering if you'd like to start by talking about that a little bit.
You know, that's exactly where I'd like to start. Euthanasia technicians and animal shelter workers and animal rescue workers in general are really unsung heroes. When people think of animal shelters, especially city and county-run shelters that are not necessarily humane societies or SPCAs or other nonprofit organizations, it's really got – they tend to get demonized, and it's unfortunate because nobody has really had the opportunity yet to put themselves in the shoes of people who do that work. I myself, in my time working in shelters, have been called every name in the book, animal killer, and more that I can't repeat on this radio station. And the fact of the matter is people don't stop and consider that the reason that you're there is because you love animals. And it's a very strange dichotomy because you're there because you love animals and you want to help them. And the other side of that coin is that you're having to kill them. And, you know, it's an unfortunate situation when you're not even heard. You know, euthanasia technicians and animal shelter workers have the most important things to say. Their voices are the ones that should be heard because they're on the front lines every day dealing with what they deal with. But unfortunately, you know, what they have to say, the impact of what they have to say, and the importance of what they have to say is often lost in the fact of what they do. Because to people who love animals, killing an animal is such a reprehensible thing to have to do, and people often just get caught up on the fact that that's what we do, is we kill animals, and so unfortunately that tends to overshadow, you know, the important information that we have to get out there about the reason that we have to kill animals. And, you know, there's a very serious missing that I think if we could bridge that gap could be of huge help to, you know, furthering our cause, reducing the numbers of euthanasia, reducing the population that is, you know, that is expansive right now.
So Jessica, let me ask you a question. What is your, and might know this better than I, but what is your background in terms of how did you get interested in working with animals and working with animal shelters and that kind of thing? What has driven you to this point? I'd like to kind of understand where you're coming from historically so that I can identify with what you're going through and dealing with today.
Absolutely. Well, you know, if we want to take it really back, it started, I believe, when I was about 7 or 8, and I started performing health exams on our household cats. And I remember even keeping records for them. They weren't as comprehensive as they probably should have been, but they were there nonetheless.
Maybe more comprehensive than I know about.
So, you know, I've had a love for animals and wanting to advocate for, you know, ever since I was a child. And, you know, I started volunteering for a veterinary hospital when I was 14 years old, every weekend while I was in high school. I like to say back before they had those pesky child labor laws. And I was actually allowed to volunteer at that time. And, you know, of course, at that time, I just did check in, you know, check people into the rooms and taking temperatures. But it was a wonderful start in getting submerged in that. Immediately after high school, I got a job with the Humane Society of Silicon Valley, where I started off as an adoption counselor. And from there, I went into our health check, you know, where we gave health exams to all of the incoming animals. And at that time, I also started my working on my 2-year degree for veterinary technology, and then I became a veterinary technician. And then from there, I went into emergency veterinary medicine, and I worked for the San Francisco SPCA in their, their emergency overnight intensive care unit. And then from there, I was recruited by the UC Davis Animal Shelter program to head up the animal care program for Solano County Animal Control. And now I'm actually working for Born Free USA, which is a national nonprofit organization that advocates on behalf of wild and exotic animals in captivity and entertainment.
Okay, that's really quite an in-depth history. This guy we got with animals. Let's give out the number again. Again, in case we're close to talking. 877-NYK Radio. 877-695-7234. And so based on that experience, what might you want to talk to people about? What subjects might people ask that you would want to discuss?
You know, unfortunately, I'm afraid that I'm having some problems. Can you repeat that? I'm it's fading out just a little bit.
I'll try again. What might some subjects be that people would call in to talk to you about now that you've given us kind of your history and what you're doing now? If people are interested in calling 877-NYK-RADIO, what might they ask you? What subjects would you like to discuss?
You know, here's the whole premise of what I'm doing at this current juncture in my career. Is that I really want to get out there what we as shelter workers and youth euthanasia technicians are up to. That being said, it's not that I want to throw in your face that this is what we do every day in terms of, you know, giving the gory little details. It's a matter of saying that the public's really been coddled to an extent of being, you know, sheltered from what really goes on and the harsh reality behind the pet overpopulation issue. And my main goal is getting out the word of what goes on, the reality of what is faced at shelters every day, so that there's a better understanding not only of how broad the issue is, but in putting, in a sense, a heart to the idea of what shelter workers and euthanasia technicians are. Like I said, there's this feeling that we're these horrible, mean, cold animal killers, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
You know, in fact, we're there because we love animals, and it breaks our hearts. And you know, to be completely frank, that the shelter, one shelter I've worked at, one euthanasia technician took his own life at the shelter. I've seen several shelter workers turn to drugs and alcohol to self-medicate what they're going through. There is something called compassion fatigue disorder, which is rampant in shelters right now. You know, the harsh reality is that, you know, again, they're the unsung heroes of what we're, of the shelter world. And I just want to bridge that gap so that people have a better understanding of why we do what we do, and, you know, how we can start to minimize that. And further, you know, within the animal shelter world itself and euthanasia technicians, you know, getting the word out there about compassion fatigue disorder, what it is, what it looks like, the symptoms of it, you know, so that people that are suffering from it can get treatment and get help.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's interesting. I would think, like what you said, and I haven't thought too much about this, someone that loves animals, you go into this line of work, and now, 90%, 95% of the animals you see are probably in distress of some type. So,
well, exactly. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting to consider is that there is a trend in people that get into advocacy. And one thing that I've noticed, and that has been noted frequently among compassion fatigue, those who work specifically in compassion fatigue, is that those who work in animal advocacy or any sort of advocacy where they're advocating on behalf of a victim have oftentimes been a victim themselves at some point. And it's not uncommon for them to get into a situation where they're now advocating for a victim without necessarily having gotten the appropriate help to manage, you know, around what happened to them, whatever it may have been. And so a lot of times what we see is a very high level of burnout because they're getting into the situation where they're trying to help other, let's say, victims, animal victims of abuse, cruelty, neglect. And when they see the magnitude of the situation and, you know, just how bad it can really be, then they're, in a sense, almost being victimized all over again because they're put in a situation where they're powerless to help. And that can really wreak havoc on somebody's psyche if they don't have a positive handle on it, if they don't have appropriate outlets and resources to deal with it. There's an extremely high level of burnout in this field.
Well, Jessica, let me ask you a question, because what you're talking about is people, is animal shelter workers having to put down pets, animals that, as far as I understand, often there's really nothing wrong with them other than no one wanted them, or, you know, their owner surrendered them. And why don't these people just take their animals to no-kill shelters and where they can just live forever, right, until they die naturally?
Well, the thing with no-kill shelters, and I don't want to generalize too much, because there's no-kill shelters, then there's the sanctuaries, and then there's, you know, animal rescues. And what's very important to know is that these are all different things in general. And what we look at with no-kill shelters, there's a few things. One is, yes, there are some situations where there's a no-kill shelter, which is more like a sanctuary. The animal is there for as long as they need until they find a home or not. But what we often see, or what we run into in these situations, is that it can very quickly become a hoarding situation where the animals are being hoarded and they're not being cared for appropriately in terms of their medical needs, their exercise needs, and anything else that they might need to live a comfortable and humane life. That can happen at times. The other thing, to be honest, that I've run into several times in my career is that how no-kill shelters can get away with being no-kill is that they don't kill animals on their premises, meaning what they do is a lot of them have contracts with a local animal control facility that's run by the county or city, which means that any animals that need to be euthanized are sent to the animal control to be euthanized. So they're not actually euthanized at the no-kill shelter, so the no-kill shelter can still maintain their no-kill status. And, I mean, to be completely frank, when I've worked at a county-run facility, we had one of those contracts with a no-kill shelter. And, you know, there was a day when they actually brought us about 72 cats to be euthanized in one day.
So what you're saying is that when I take my pet to a no-kill shelter because I want to make sure that my pet doesn't get euthanized just because it's one too many cat or dog, and I hasten to add, I would not ever take one of my animals to a shelter because I believe when you adopt an animal, it's for life. But if I were someone who felt they had no other option, what you're saying is I would be believing that my animal was going to get to live out its life naturally. I would be relying on that, and yet once I left and walked out the door, they might be taking my cat or dog and shipping it off somewhere else to be euthanized?
What's important to understand is that once you leave that animal at that shelter, it is legally theirs, and they can do whatever they want with it. So, yes, that can absolutely happen. Does it happen every time? Is every shelter no-kill shelter like that? Absolutely not. But the thing to remember is this. There are literally tens of millions of animals euthanized in the United States every year. To think that it's possible that there are enough no-kill shelters to manage all of these animals for the duration of their life makes absolutely no sense. That's just not possible. I would love it if the numbers were that possible. Anybody who works in animal sheltering and rescue would love it if that were possible, but it's just not possible. So that leaves two options. Either they're hoarding a lot of animals, and perhaps that's not the most ideal situation for the animals, or they're having to find other options. Now, that being said, I've come across a lot of sanctuaries and no-kill facilities that do a wonderful job. But then what the trade-off there is that they don't accept any animal. They accept the animals that are considered adoptable because they know they have a good chance of being able to move them out. So if you look at your city and county shelters, they have to accept anything that comes through their doors, whether it's dogs, cats, ferals, wildlife, livestock, you name it, they accept it. But no-kill facilities and sanctuaries can be choosy, and that's a luxury, which, you know, works really well for them. But if you just look at the sheer numbers, pure logic tells you that, unfortunately, a completely no-kill nation is just not feasible at this time.
All right, we're talking with Jessica Stout, who is an animal rights advocate. She's been working in the animal rights advocacy arena for most of her life. If you want to call and ask her a question, the number is 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. And I'm thinking, Jessica, somebody that might be interested in calling in might be somebody that adopted an animal and, you know, maybe hasn't thought through the whole process. Like, well gosh, in 5 or 10 years, when this animal is really old, what do I need to do? Hopefully they're like Ann, who says, you know, I'm adopting it for life. I'll keep it until the animal dies. But do you see people, you know, on a daily or weekly basis that maybe just don't know how to care for their animal anymore, or they're moving, or what are the different examples of reasons people might need to find one of these shelters and take their animals to?
You know, absolutely. One of the number one reasons that dogs are returned to shelters is for behavior reasons. And almost every time, it's because that dog did not go through basic obedience training. We cannot impress enough when a dog leaves their shelter, a shelter once you've adopted an animal, even if you buy it from a breeder, training is key because, yes, the puppy is cute when he's 8 weeks old and, you know, 10 pounds. But when he's a 70-pound dog that's untrained and very strong, he can quickly become a lot of room in your house. So one of the number one reasons that we get is because the animal is untrained and it's usually turned in for behavior problems, which is unfortunate because, to be quite honest, at that point, the owner's failed their dog. You know, there's no reason. You don't buy a new car without doing a lot of research on picking the right car. Just as much, if not more, research should go into bringing a new life into your house. Secondly, we get a lot of people that turn in their animals because they're moving, you know, unfortunately. And so we see a lot of displaced animals. And, you know, when you're in the throes of, say, something like during the summertime when it's what we call kitten season and we're getting kittens by the box load through the door, you know, your 5-year-old cat that you're abandoning because you're moving is not going to have good chances of getting adopted because, quite honestly, a cute kitten next to an adult cat, it's pretty hard to compete.
That's so sad.
It's unfortunate. It really is. And you know, it's, again, it's one of those things where a lot of the times, you know, shelters really have to shelter the owners from what occurs and what's so in terms of, you know, the chances of adoptability. But again, like I said, I'm at the point where it just seems that dialogue needs to be opened. And the fact is that a lot of owner surrenders. One thing to keep in mind is in a lot of states, whereas there's a stray hold period, and if an animal is a stray, they have to be held for so long before they can be evaluated to either be put up for adoption or put down or sent to rescue. If an animal is an owner surrender, that owner is there to turn over ownership to the shelter, and so any decisions that are made on behalf of the animal are made straight away.
So let me ask you a question, Jessica. You said that you know that the shelters are trying to shelter the owner from the reality, but why? Because don't you think that if the owner really knew the truth, that they would be perhaps less likely to surrender?
You know, you would think that, and, you know, the thing is that oftentimes they're already defensive when they get there because they're guilty that they're giving up their animal, but sometimes it's shelter policy, depending on the shelter. If it's a shelter that, you know, relies on donations, it may be hard to strike that balance between making sure that people are very clear, you know, where things stand, and also making sure that you're not losing on a potential donation. And let me clarify to say that it's not because, you know, the shelter's looking to make a profit. They actually lose money on each animal. And so it's vital. Donations are very vital. Also, sometimes if it's a city or county-run shelter, you know, those directives on what you can and can't say may be coming from a higher authority that's not even in animal control. You know, if you're part of general services or something like that, and they don't really understand the actual runnings of a shelter, then you're up against a lot of red tape in terms of policies that go on within the shelter.
So Jessica,
okay,
let me ask you this, just so I'm not an animal guy. We don't have pets. I had a dog growing up, but I married a woman who doesn't like stray hair. And I think she married me because I was already bald when we met. So she doesn't like mess, right? So and you know, chalk that up for what you will. She's a horrible person, whatever. But the point is that I don't have a lot of exposure with this. So I have a question though. I don't think that you want to say, and I don't think you are saying this, that anybody that brings an animal to a shelter is a bad person or that it's the wrong thing to do. It is true, I guess, that in times the person has failed the animal and they didn't give proper training or something like that. But here's an example. You tell me if this would fit in as a correct reason to maybe bring an animal to you. My in-laws have a dog, and they've had this dog, gosh, probably 18 years. I mean, this dog is very, very old, and it's diabetic. And so it has hundreds of dollars a month of medical expenses. Now, my in-laws, fortunately, are able to provide that, but I can easily see where somebody would not be able to afford that. And in that case, what is that person to do with their animal? Just let them die, take them into the vet to get put down, or what would be a reasonable course of action for somebody in that kind of a situation?
If an animal has an illness and it's a chronic illness that is going to be ongoing costly medical care, turning it into the shelter is not going to get at that medical care. It's more than likely going to be euthanized, unless it's a situation where, depending on, you know, the treatment and how old the animal is and what breed it is, it could perhaps be sent to rescue. Rescue groups that rescue certain breeds. There's breed rescue groups. There's, you know, rescue groups that, you know, rescue senior dogs or black dogs. I mean, there's a rescue out there for a lot of different types of dogs. So there is a chance that perhaps it's something where they can be sent to rescue. Some shelters may have, if they're, you know, they have a good budget and they're a nonprofit entity, they may have the budget to be able to treat that animal until it gets adopted out and in special circumstances, you know, adopted out to a family that's willing to take on its medical care. If I were to say an 18-year-old animal that's an unregulated diabetic, likely no, it's going to be put to sleep. So then the question is it more fair to put that dog to sleep at the shelter with strangers, or is it more fair to take it to the vet where it can be in a less stressful environment without a ton of dogs barking around it and with people that they know to say goodbye to them?
You're listening to Jessica Stout on Now You Know Radio, and you can call us at 877-NYK-RADIO, but you can also tweet us at Now You Know Radio. So if you have a question for Jessica Stout, she's written Confessions of the Euthanasia Technician. She's working on two books now. She works in the animal rescue and rights field. If you have a question for her, call in or send us a tweet.
Okay, Jessica, now I have a question. I have a question for you, Ann.
Not
real quick.
You.
I
for
know,
me?
But I have,
okay.
Yeah, I have a question for you because I, you know, as technologically advanced as I am in many, many areas, Twitter still escapes me for a number of reasons. And I know how to send my own tweets with my own account, but when you tell me to tweet at Now You Know Radio, tell me how that works. I wouldn't know how to do that, even though I do know how to send my own tweets.
Well, that is all you do is you put in the beginning of your tweet, you put the at symbol, no space, Now You Know Radio, and then a space in your message, and it will come directly to us.
That's all you do?
That's all you do.
Okay, I was trying to make it more complex. All right, now, sidebar over, continue.
You are always trying to make things more complicated, Brian.
I guess so. Let's see what this button does.
Now, Brian, I see that we have a caller with a question.
Yes, yeah, I was waiting for you to start talking to Jessica again so that I could safely and quietly jump into the call screening room and talk to whoever this person is. But thanks for calling out my inadequacy.
I am going to ask Jessica a question. In fact, I'm going to ask her two questions. It's a two-part question, Jessica. I'm wondering, I know that you have had many experiences that are really very sad and have made you, I think, rightly so, pretty unhappy. And you also have had experiences that had some really nice happy endings where they might not have had you not interceded. And I'm wondering if you could please tell us first a story something that you really think people ought to know that happened that just shouldn't have happened, that was a travesty of justice, but quickly follow that with a story that has a nice happy ending so that we don't bum too many people out for too long.
Yes. To answer your first question, one of the situations that stands out in my mind is actually a situation where we were extremely full on dogs, and we had a gentleman bring in 10 8-week-old pit bull puppies that his female dog had given birth to, and he brought them in to be euthanized. And the reason that he wanted them euthanized was because he was going on vacation, and he did not want to pay for a pet sitter. The law is that if an owner brings in their animal and signs them to be euthanized, we legally have to euthanize them. And the fact of the matter is even if we wanted to break the law and go against that, they were 10-week-old pit bull puppies, which generally I'm very cautious about adopting them out, not because I think they're a bad breed or anything like that, but the location that I was in, the city that we service, we got some pretty unsavory characters in there wanting to adopt for pit bulls for some pretty unsavory reasons. So as it was, I tend to be very cautious about adopting pit bull or pit bull type dogs out. And when possible, I wanted to send them to rescue. And certainly those rescues are always full, and it'd be really hard for them to place 10 puppies. But back to the original point that we were required at the time to actually put them down. So
that's heartbreaking.
It was extremely heartbreaking. You know, it was, you know, 10 new lives that could have been prevented had they spayed their dog or didn't let her breed. But they did. And, you know, it was one of those situations where as a euthanasia technician, you get a little bitter and say, you know what, I'm tired of cleaning up after your mess. This is your doing, and now you get to go on vacation scot-free while, you know, I kill 10 puppies and cry in my car for an hour.
Jessica, that's a really interesting perspective. I mean, stuff like that never even has crossed my mind. And we've got a caller, Rob, who called in 877-NYK-RADIO, 877-695-7234. Call in if you want to talk. It's got a very interesting question, I think, that fits in very well to that story. So, Rob, if you're with us, the floor is yours. Jessica is here to talk to you.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Rob.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good, too, but that's not my main question for the show.
That was easy.
Well, I just wanted to ease you into it, but here's my question. What are your thoughts about certifying people for pet ownership, and what might be the pros and cons of that?
I'm going to ask you first to define what you mean by certifying people.
So when I got my cats, I made a commitment for life, either my life or their life.
Right.
And to me, it just seems sort of foreign to me that people would adopt a pet and at a later date, you know, say, oh, I'm moving now. I don't want to put them in a shelter, so I'll just let them loose on the street. Or like the example you just gave, a person has all these pets, doesn't want to pay to get a sitter, and so decides to euthanize them. And I guess what I'm saying is that in order to – so what I'm suggesting here is, what are your thoughts on the notion of saying that in order for a person to be a pet owner, they have to achieve some kind of certification as a pet owner, like a license. They can't have a pet without this. And then the process of being certified would be to minimize these problems that we are seeing with pet ownership.
Gotcha. You know, I think that's a really interesting concept. Where we might run into some issues is a few places. You know, one is resources. So most shelters, I almost want to venture to say all, but I'll say most, shelters are chronically understaffed, especially if they're shelters that are run by city or county, because one thing to understand is animal control for any city or county is a black hole financially. And so as such, they tend to get very minimal in terms of the funding that they're allotted every year in the budget. And and therefore the way that they staff their shelter is on a minimal budget. So one of the things you have to look at is, well, what are the resources that are going to be involved in doing some kind of pet certification? You know, even with volunteers, unfortunately, you know, there are always those amazing volunteers that are there faithfully to do their shift, and we love them for it. But a lot of times what we run into are the volunteers that are maybe there for a month or two, come when they can, realize it's a huge commitment, and then they kind of fade away into the background. And so sometimes it can also be a volunteer management issue where we say, okay, if we want to do something like a pet certification program, what resources do we have available to us without volunteers? What resources, how would the resources expand if we got volunteers? But then what might we run into if, say, we didn't have viable volunteers that were willing to stick and give the commitment? The other side of that would be then if we were to certify someone as a pet owner, is what would be the penalty if they went against that? In a lot of states, California included, while there are some laws for egregious acts against animals in terms of abuse or torture or anything like that, animals are seen as property. So they're not seen as beings, living beings that can feel and physical pain and can be stressed or sad or depressed or anything like that. That's why a lot of times you see, say, there's a situation where there was a dog fight or somebody hit somebody else's animal, the car, and killed them. The most penalties that the victim is awarded is the cost of the animal. There's never any pain and suffering awarded, or rarely if it's in a state where they're considered material possessions. Any pain and suffering awarded for that animal, you get a very basic, oh, you spent $60 on the adoption fee, this is what you get. And then, of course, any vet bills that are, you know, need to be reimbursed. So then the question would be, well, how would we enforce that to say you went against your agreement to be this licensed guardian, so now you have to do X, Y, Z? There's really not going to be a lot of enforcement on that side of it. So there's those two things. That you know, could run into it. And so I think the concept is a wonderful concept. It's just one that might need to be fleshed out to say, what does that look like? And then the other side of it is if it seems too daunting, would that scare off adopters? Because as it is, just the most shelters have, you know, an adoption questionnaire that needs to be filled out. And, you know, sometimes even people coming in are like, you know, wow, I understand, but geez, this is a lot to go through. It's like I'm adopting a child. And that's really there in place to say, okay, how serious are you about adopting an animal? Are you willing to go through this to understand, you know, the life and the responsibility that you're taking on? But, you know, if it gets to the point where people are saying, okay, gosh, this is a lot of hoops that I'm jumping through to adopt an animal, we might actually see adoptions decline a little bit.
Jessica, can you tell us now one of the uplifting stories you have?
Sure. I will actually tell one of my favorite stories about a bulldog who I called Chance. And I'll give the very condensed version because the longer, more detailed version is on my website, confessionsfromtheanimalshelter.com. But it's about a bulldog that came into one of the shelters for which I worked. And he came in with five other dogs, and the dogs had gotten out of the neighbor's or the owner's yard, and this had been, I believe, strike three. And a couple of the dogs had attacked and killed chickens, and they were unsure which dogs it was that did it. And because these dogs had gotten out before, they were all deemed dangerous and all condemned to be put to sleep. Well, there was one particular dog in the bunch who I call Chance. And he was an American bulldog, and he was just the most polite, sweetest dog that I had ever met in my life. And he quickly became a staff favorite, and we just couldn't believe that he was this mean, horrible, evil chicken killer. And so, you know, on a whim one day, we took him out into the barnyard area where we actually had some chickens and very cautiously tested him with those chickens, and he really could have cared less about the chickens. And we felt fairly confident at that point that he didn't have a strong prey drive that would cause him to chase chickens and kill them. And at the same time, there was a bomb detection unit that came through that they were looking for dogs that would test well for bomb detection. This wasn't uncommon. They came through from time to time, and they actually zeroed in on him fairly quickly, and he tested well. But unfortunately, he was condemned to die by the judge. So what we did, which I'll let you all in on a little secret, which does happen in shelters from time to time, is we put him in what we call the doggy protection program, which means that by all accounts, he was euthanized, as we stated he was, but in reality, he was quietly slipped into the bomb squad, where he is now a bomb detection dog.
Well, that's fantastic. Wow. You know, that would seem. I as some may know, I'm a video media producer by day, and to me, that just sounds like an incredible documentary story of watching. I'm sure if you go with a camera crew into a shelter, you're going to get 9 out of 10 heartbreaking stories, but maybe you get that one incredible story like you just shared that really just just makes your heart sing. Of course, I guess you couldn't share it then, because then his cover would be blown, right?
Exactly. You know, I have to say, though, it's those stories that keep us going. It really is. And, yeah, you know, it's one of those things where every shelter worker's done it. We've all done that one little thing where, you know, it's just an altruistic move. Like, okay, I understand that this is the law, but this isn't right. And quite frankly, when you're working in a situation where you're advocating on behalf of those that can't speak for themselves, you tend to buck the system of what's right and wrong in society's eyes or the court's eyes or legal code's eyes. And that's okay, because we're not the actual animal control officers. So we didn't take that.
Jessica, we just had a question come in through our Twitter feed. And the question is, do you feel that the penalties that people who abuse their animals receive are strong enough?
No, not at all. And I'll give you a good example. One of my first foster dogs, Pele, a little pit bull, she was called into 911, actually, by the neighbors of her owner because she had been chained in the backyard and the chain had been wrapped around her neck and she was choking. By the time animal control got there, she was in shock, and they had also found that her owners had poured a very caustic acid on her back, and they had cut her face with a knife several times. By the time she got to the vet hospital, she was almost dead, and they were able to work on her very quickly, and they did save her life. And then what happened is poor little Pele was stuck in the shelter as a evidence hold. And unfortunately, with a lot of evidence holds, depending on where you are, they have to stay there in the shelter. So after Pele had been through this extremely traumatic event and was trying to heal in a very noisy, very crowded shelter, she was an evidence hold that couldn't be sent to rescue right away or into foster care while her owners were awaiting their court date, which kept being pushed back. In the end, she was in the shelter for about 6 months before we finally went to the judge and said, look, this is unfair. She needs to go into foster care. So she came home with me, and I fostered her. She received constructive surgery on her back to repair the burns that were left by the acid. When her owners got to court, their punishment was a $500 fine, and that was it. So no, I don't unfortunately think that for the most part people are fined enough or given enough punishment for cruelty to animals. One is because a lot of times we see that cruelty to animals can lead to other much bigger things. If you look at most serial killers or psychopaths or sociopaths that are diagnosed as being violent, oftentimes they started with animals. And so I don't think it's something that we take seriously enough. The other thing is that, you know, beyond saying, okay, for you to be in legal compliance of keeping your animal, you have to give them food, water, and shelter, and that's about it. To go beyond that and assess damages, even, criminal damages for pain and suffering, would then have to take them from being labeled as property to being labeled as beings. And there's a lot of pushback on that from a lot of organizations such as, you know, the agricultural side of things that, you know, they have cows and other livestock that they actively slaughter. So if we were to say that dogs and cats are, you know, living, feeling beings that, you know, if there's an act of cruelty and they're slaughtered, so somebody should be criminalized for that, well, then it's going to be, in their mind, a slippery slope down to say, okay, well, if it's not okay to slaughter cats and dogs, then why is it okay to slaughter cows and pigs? So, and fortunately, you know, special interest groups have a lot of money to fight initiatives that are brought up to consider domestic animals as, you know, beings that can feel pain, emotional, physical, mental pain, that would allow us to then enforce stricter rules.
Now, that brings up an interesting question that I have. Jessica, are you a vegetarian or vegan or on that side of the aisle?
I am.
Okay,
but,
so the reason,
you know,
let me ask my question just so you can understand where I'm coming from. And is it possible for someone to be an animal lover, a pet lover, but also understand that we kill cows and we kill pigs for food and that kind of a thing? Or to you, is that a difficult line to walk?
You know, here's the thing, is what I've realized is it's really just a matter of the realm and the reality that each person lives in. I'm not going to say me being a vegetarian is a personal choice. And I'm definitely not one of those people that if I go out to dinner with you and you order a burger, I'm going to shoot you daggers across the table all night. You know, because again, it's a personal choice. Do I advocate for it? Sure. Do I preach about it? No, I don't. That's not my thing. That's not what I do. I'm not going to sit there and say that you know, somebody that I know who eats meat but has a cat doesn't love their cat, because that's ridiculous. You know, what I will say is perhaps they haven't made that connection to consider that, you know, farm animals have the capacity to you know, care for their owners and have affectionate thoughts and behavior just like, you know, cats and dogs do, which we know they do if you know much about, you know, livestock. But I'm certainly not going to minimize people who eat animals but also love another type of animal, because, you know, we're not in their heads and we don't know kind of how they consider that and think about it. So, yeah.
Well, it's an interesting scenario, because you've got I don't want to say anything specific so that I don't particularly offend or get incorrect, but there are certain cultures in the world that, for example, eat dog. And
right.
We in Americans, we hear that, and it completely revolts us. Like, what? How could you possibly consider doing that? And then, but then, you know, we're eating other animals. And just for complete clarity, I am not a vegetarian. I would be the one ordering the burger across the table from you. But I also, you know, I love dogs and I love cats. And I guess so. I guess I haven't made the connection yet, or I don't know what my mental capacity is for not quite bridging that gap, whatever it is. But it's interesting that it does. Is it cultural? I mean, is that why we don't think twice about killing a cow or a pig, but to think of somebody eating a dog is tantamount to an egregious crime? I don't know where that comes from. If that's just a cultural thing or how that comes about.
Well, I think it's absolutely a cultural thing. And to give you another comparison to sort of drive that home for you, is that a lot of people have cats and dogs that they love very much, but they see nothing wrong with wearing fur. But those same people would be horrified to know that a lot of the fur trim that may be on their clothes is actually cat and dog that has been imported from China, where they do have cat and dog fur farms.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are you serious?
You know, definitely. I'm dead serious. And in fact, I just found out today that in Canada, it is perfectly legal to use dog and cat fur as fur trim for garments and, you know, other fashion accessories. And so, yeah, for us, we can say that's the most horrid, wretched thing I've ever heard in my life. But that's because we as a culture hold cats and dogs as companion animals. Whereas, say, in China, where they have the cat and dog fur farms, you know, they're seeing it as just their livelihood.
So, Jess, this is a really good segue to a question I wanted to ask you, Jessica, and then also we have another question from a listener. But,
mm-hmm.
but because you are right where you are right now in your conversation, I wanted to ask you about one of the things I was reading about was that you, first of all, you run something called Sad Shows, which, as I understand it, you host or put on or create fashion shows around the country that are to benefit local animal rescue organizations, local to wherever you're putting on the show. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then related to that, and this brings it back to what we were just talking about, I read that you have a new line of, is it accessories that are coming out with feathers that are gathered, they're feathers that have, I guess, fallen out just, you know, through the natural course of molting from birds that are at sanctuaries, and then the things that you sell made out of those feathers go back, some part of that goes back to help fund the sanctuary. Do I have that? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, actually. So the line that I'm coming out with is called Ethical Feathers. And right now I'm working with the Central Virginia Parrot Sanctuary. And what occurred to me with myself, actually, is that I'm an admitted, you know, I hoard clothes, accessories, jewelry, you name it, I love it. And that's how Fab Shows was actually born, is I brought my two loves together, fashion and animals. And what I realized is that as much as I love feathers and my jewelry and accessories, it occurred to me I never really thought about where it was coming from, which, you know, goes back to what Brian was saying. If you work in one, you know, section of domestic animal issues, you may not actually occur to you to even think about the other issues. But what I found out is that indeed most of these feathers do come from slaughterhouses and other not so savory situations. And at the same time, I also know a lot of wonderful wild bird sanctuaries. You know, one of my colleagues, Monica Engebretson at Born Free USA, is actually very active in our exotic bird campaign. She founded National Bird Day, and she's been a wealth of information for me to learn about the issues with captive exotic birds. And she directed me towards Matt Smith, who is the executive director for the Central Virginia Parrot Sanctuary. And so what I'm working with him is he's actually sending me the feathers of their residents, and their feathers that have naturally molted off of the bird, meaning they've just naturally fallen off, and they're collecting them and sending them to me. And from there, what I'm doing is I'm making them into humane jewelry and other accessories. And a portion of the proceeds goes back to the Central Virginia Parrot Sanctuary, as well as with each piece comes a little informational piece that talks about the parrot sanctuary, their work, the kind of bird it came from, and the plight that's faced by that particular bird.
So if people wanted to see this, and I have to say that is really, really cool, but if people wanted to see these feather accessories or find out more about your fashion shows to benefit animals, where would they go?
I'm still in the creation process of the jewelry and the accessories. I'm still in the production phase. So what I would say is go to fabshows.org/blog, and that's where I'm going to continue to give updates and announcements about that, as well as you can actually go to the sanctuary website itself, which is madmacaws.net, and you can learn more about what they do and you know, why we're helping them and what a wonderful sanctuary they are. And if anything that I've said has piqued your interest in saying, oh, I didn't realize there was a plight faced by captive exotic birds, I would highly encourage you to go to nationalbirdday.com and check out what they have to say, and read a little bit about you know, the illegal bird trade and exactly what does go on with the beautiful birds that we tend to see in pet shops.
And that original site, Fab Shows, that's FABSHOWS.org, right?
Correct. Fab, like you're so fab, darling.
Bree, and her question is, how do you feel about the explosion of the rescue animal TV type shows like Pit Boss? And I know there have been some others as well, and I know at one point there was going to be My Monkey Baby or something like that, which thankfully I think ended up not happening. But she's wondering how you feel about those shows and whether you feel they could cause sort of a flurry of adoptions, but for the wrong reasons, that are, you know, a negative reason for adopting. And her example was kind of like 101 Dalmatians when that came out, causing so many people to run out and adopt Dalmatians, or well, people, you know, adopting bunnies at Easter, but not because they are thinking about a bunny is, you know, a multi-year long commitment, but oh, it's so cute and fluffy. And so how do you feel about shows that sort of glorify perhaps the wrong aspect of being involved with animals like that?
Well, I think it's important that we go back to what I originally said, in that, you know, you put a lot of time and effort into researching what kind of car you're going to get, so please do the same thing with animals when you're taking on a life. Especially, you know, yes, we saw a boom. When 101 Dalmatians came out, the shelters got overrun with Dalmatians, because what happened is that, you know, children saw this movie, said, I want, parents said, okay. In reality, Dalmatians are not necessarily the best breed to get for kids. Dalmatians are wonderful dogs, and they can be wonderful dogs. But the other thing to remember is that Dalmatians have a very high energy level, and they need to be exercised. And, you know, what we were finding is that a lot of people were getting these dogs to be quote-unquote family dogs, and the dogs didn't necessarily fit their lifestyle, and then they ended up at the shelter. We saw the same thing as we're handling right now with Beverly Hills Chihuahua. We are now consequently overrun with Chihuahuas. So, yeah, unfortunately, breeds become fads, and it's the animals that suffer in the end when you know, people kind of get the idea of getting a dog like it was some kind of, you know, handbag that they just saw in the latest issue of Vogue.
So would you suggest then go as far as this? For example, with 101 Dalmatians, I mean, those the mom and dad Dalmatian and the puppies, I mean, they were wonderful with the kids. And in Beverly Hills Chihuahua, the Chihuahuas talked. So, yeah, I could certainly see that people might have been disappointed when their Chihuahua didn't talk. But I wonder if you would go as far as suggesting that Hollywood is actually perhaps a bit irresponsible in terms of how they portray animals, which then leads to these problems with you know, the adoption of the animals with wrong expectations.
Absolutely. If you look at, unfortunately the name is failing me, but there's a very popular recent Will Ferrell movie that involved basketball. And there was a bear in that movie. And, you know, the bear, of course, was trained and seemed like a cool idea. And, you know, would you leave that movie saying, I'm going to bring home a bear? And, you know, incidentally, that bear after the movie ended up attacking and killing its trainer. So even the animals that we see, you know, on screen are not necessarily what we think they are. And the other thing you have to consider is what methods are used to keep them in line to do what they do to perform.
Jeff, we have I'm sorry, Jeff. Oh, go ahead, Brian. But
I'm gonna jump in just because this is not even a major point, but my right wing conservatism is rearing its ugly head. I hate blaming stuff like Hollywood when if the easy answer is, well, the people are stupid, then that's where the blame needs to be put. I don't particularly care from my perspective if a movie comes out that does show Dalmatians as great family animals, good with the kids, cute Chihuahuas that talk. It comes back to what Jessica said. The people need to do the research on what they're going to do. They're the ones being stupid, making the mistake of bringing an animal into their life that doesn't necessarily fit. I don't want to take the responsibility away from them as kind of the point where this problem is created. And based on that, let me ask you this. If somebody does do research, they decide they want an animal, they bring it into their house, and if it's not working out, is it from your perspective then, well, you agreed to adopt this animal, so it is for life. I mean, you're going to keep it until one of you dies, or are there situations where you've seen or that would be legitimate where this animal just isn't fitting with our lifestyle? We need to find somewhere where it does fit better. What are those kind of situations, and do those exist?
Absolutely, I've seen situations where we said, wow, this is not a good situation. And, you know, generally what we want to do is keep the best interest of the animal in mind and then keep the best interest of the family in mind. And what I've asked people to do is say, okay, I understand it's not a fit. We don't have a lot of room at the shelter, to be quite honest. If we put your animal back up for adoption, that takes away from another animal. Would you be willing to foster this dog while we look for another home for it. And, you know, generally we can move it into, if we can find a rescue or find another home, you know, if the family's committed to say, look, it's not working out for us, but, you know, we're committed to you know, doing what we can to ensure that, that our responsibility to this animal continues to the point of making sure that it's safe and we do find a good fit for it, then, you know, certainly I don't fault them for that.
Well, no, that's interesting. So fostering, like I said, I have not in my adult life had an animal, had a pet, like a dog or a cat. We've had a slew of fish, but those typically, we keep those until they are no longer with us. But okay, so fostering an animal, that's something that exists. That's a program that somebody can take part in.
Oh, it's a huge program. Oh, it's a huge program. And God, we need foster homes like you wouldn't believe. You know, if we can get an animal out of the shelter and into foster, that's going to be an ideal situation because so much less stress on the animal. It frees up space at the shelter for other animals to go up for adoption. And then you truly get an idea as an adopter what that animal is like in a home environment, which is going to set them up for the best success in matching them with a family. So, you know, if anybody takes anything away from tonight, it's that if you have the capacity and the ability to foster a cat or a dog, please contact your local shelter or rescue group and sign up because it's such a selfless, wonderful thing to do. There are great programs out there that will assist you. They usually cover all the food, medical expenses, and everything. They just need a place for that animal to sleep at night. And, you know, Brian, poodles shed very little, so.
But this actually leads into the you know, it's about time to wrap up, and we're just so glad that you came, and we hope you'll come back. But I had a last question that I wanted to give you, to ask you, and you just sort of led right into it without – you're just wonderful, which is for the people out there listening who may really feel like, wow, I want to do more for animals. I really want to get involved with animal rescue, and who may not really know where to start or really have any idea of what that means. What would you say to them?
Foster if you can foster. If you can't foster, consider giving some of your time each week to the shelter to volunteer. They need people to walk the dogs and socialize with the cats, keep them happy and comfortable, you know, while they're there. You know, another thing is if you're really handy with, you know, computer, Twitter, Facebook, managing websites, you know, usually they can always help and they need help in getting their animals that are available for adoption uploaded onto sites like PetFinder.com or other similar sites that help them maximize their adoption. So if you can, you know, if you have any web experience, that can always go to good use. You know, the good old-fashioned throwing some catnip in some, you know, making little sock toys. You know, I mean, there's so many things you can do to help an animal that even if you're allergic, that would make all of the difference. What I would suggest you do is go on to the website of your local shelter and see what their needs are right now. You know, a lot of times they have a wish list on there of things that they need, like blankets and food. And, you know, you can organize a food drive or a blanket drive, and it really can make – you can directly impact the quality of life for an animal, and it means so much. So there's a couple of ways to help out and get involved.
So that really can make a difference, even some of those smaller steps. Because I think people feel, you know, they heard you say that, you know, the thousands and thousands of animals that are euthanized every you know, week or year, and, you know, the 10 puppies that came in that you had to put down because the owner didn't want them and wanted to go on vacation. And, you know, it seems like such an insurmountable problem that I could see that people might feel like, you know, well, what, you know, how can my little effort make any difference at all? But you're saying it really can make a difference, a real difference.
You know, I hate to be cheesy and go back to the starfish story of the person throwing the starfish back into the water after they had washed up, and the person said, you know, all of these starfish that are washed up, how are you making a difference to all of them? And the other person picked up the starfish and threw it in the water and said, I made a difference to that one. And that's so true. If you make a difference in the life of one shelter dog, even if that dog ends up getting euthanized, they were going to get euthanized, and that's unfortunate. Ignoring the problem isn't going to make it go away. But giving them a fluffy blanket or a treat or a toy to play with up until that point makes all of the difference in the world.
Well, and I got to imagine that anybody that does that is better off for having done it. So they're going to be enriched in their life. I'm just thinking of, you know, what a wonderful program to maybe introduce to churches and the elderly and stuff. You know, they can take care of a cat or can take care of a dog for a few weeks or a few months, whatever it takes. This is great. I my eyes are open because I really had no idea of the fostering environment, and so that's a pretty exciting thing for me to hear about.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And there are some wonderful organizations out there that are, you know, like Senior Saving Seniors, and it's senior citizens that are out there saving senior animals.
Oh, that's great.
It's a wonderful program.
That is cool. And so, Brian, next week I look forward to hearing about the new foster fish that you're going to have.
We might have some foster fish.
If I could just mention two more things before really quickly. For anybody out there that is in the sheltering environment, I think it's really vital that you educate yourself on compassion fatigue syndrome, which affects a numerous amount of shelter workers and rescue workers. And I wanted to direct you to compassionfatigue.org. Patricia Smith, the founder, she is a certified specialist in compassion fatigue. She's been doing this for over 20 years. She has several workbooks out and education books that are just amazing, and there's actually an interview with her on my website, confessionsfromtheanimalshelter.com, and again, she's at compassionfatigue.org, and I believe that link is going to be posted. And then the other thing for those of you who want to learn more about what life is like in the shelter, there is an amazing book by Tammy L. Harbolt, and it's called Bridging the Bond, The Cultural Construction of the Shelter Pet, and it's written by Tammy, who has rescued animals and is a shelter volunteer, and she actually does very frank interviews with shelter workers and shelter volunteers and does some really interesting investigations on the impact of you know, the cultural construction of shelters, and it offers wonderful insight. There's also going to be a link on that. So I highly recommend checking out both of those amazing ladies because they are just pioneers in this field. And they're definitely something to add to your library and looking for some good reading.
Okay,
we'll try to put all these links up on our show notes and on our site blog, talkradio.com/nowyouknow.
Wonderful.
And just
thank you.
One more thing, would you please, what was your main site again?
And my site is confessionsfromtheanimalshelter.com.
Jessica, thank you so much for joining us. This has been it's been really eye-opening, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. I would love to come back. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you for the last hour.
All right, Ann. So we're going to be set for next week, 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific. Right? Yes.
You got it.
Okay. See you next week.
I'll see you and your fish then, Brian.
Okay. Talk to you later.